Thank you. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next to number 88-1076, J. Paul Presseau versus Interstate Commerce Commission. Mr. Berger, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case involves a congressional attempt to preempt state real property law throughout the country and, in so doing, transform private property into public recreational hiking and biking trails. This morning, I would like to address key elements of the two fundamental issues in this case. First, the invalidity of this statute under the Fifth Amendment, examining both the Second Circuit's broad holding that under no set of facts could this statute ever be a taking of property, and then discussing the inability of the claims court to provide compensation for any taking which might occur because of the strict congressional prohibition on the expenditure of funds which were not appropriated for the purpose of this statute. Second, I would like to discuss the invalidity of this statute as a Commerce Clause regulatory measure in light of the fact that the Interstate Commerce Commission cannot approve the conversion of an abandoned railroad right-of-way to a recreational hiking or biking trail until after it first determines that there is no future railroad need for the particular right-of-way in question. I'd like to turn first, then, to the Fifth Amendment problems in this case. First, what the statute does is clearly to override and change settled state law. The reason, in fact, why this statute was enacted in 1983 as an amendment to the National Trails Act was that trail groups had tried to transform abandoned railroad rights-of-way into recreational trails before that, and found themselves confronted by state courts which would not permit it. And the reason that the state courts would not permit it is that what the railroads acquired, usually in the 1800s, was an easement for railroad right-of-way purposes. And under settled state law in virtually every state in this nation, once the railroads stopped using the right-of-way for railroad purposes, for running trains, the easement would vanish, and the underlying fee title owner would be entitled to full use, enjoyment, and possession of the property. So that state courts were not, based on that body of law, permitting the transformation of abandoned rights of way into some other use, because the railroad, in a very classic sense, owned nothing and therefore could transfer nothing.
Mr. Berger, is it possible that the state law that applies to define the property interest of your clients would take into account the federal determinations of public purpose or railway use? Is it possible that the state law determination would look back at the federal position?
I believe it does work into the calculus, Justice O'Connor. The way that it works in is that it's been consistently held both by this court and by the Vermont Supreme Court that until the Interstate Commerce Commission declares an abandonment of a railroad right-of-way, there is no room for the state law to come into effect. State law until that point is preempted by the Supremacy Clause. And my clients have no quarrel with that state of affairs where the Interstate Commerce Commission, exercising its expertise on the need for rail transportation and the need for particular rights of way determines whether the abandonment of a right of way is appropriate in a particular case. Once there is an abandonment, however, this court's opinions are likewise clear that state law then takes over and controls, and the ICC and the federal determinations are out of the picture. And
well, here, of course, they may take the position that there still has been no abandonment because of the ultimate reserved potential use.
The way that that works, Justice O'Connor, is that before the ICC considers whether to approve the negotiations between a railroad and either a state or local agency or a recognized trail organization to transform this right-of-way into a recreational right-of-way from a full-blown transportation right-of-way, the ICC first has to determine that it is appropriate for the railroad to abandon railroad usage of this right-of-way and that there is neither present nor future public railroad need for the right-of-way. That's in Section 10903, 49 U.S.C., and the statute is very clear. The ICC is also very clear on that. They said earlier this year that in every trails case, before they reach the trail question, they will already have decided that the public use does not require continued railroad usage and permits the railroad to fully abandon the railroad usage.
Even if you are correct so far, I suppose it's arguable that you still have a Tucker Act remedy for your clients to get compensation.
That is certainly the other question in this case, and I'd be happy to address that since Your Honor is interested in it. The Tucker Act, of course, and I must confess I find it strange standing here arguing that there is no right on behalf of my clients to recover compensation and find the Solicitor General arguing, oh yes, they should be getting money for this. Analyzing the Tucker Act question gets us into the issue of what action Congress authorized the federal government to take. And it may get a little bit technical, but this court in Ruckelshaus versus Monsanto and the Regional Rail Reorganization Act cases most recently concluded that the Tucker Act and a suit for compensation in the claims court is available for authorized governmental activity. And only for authorized governmental activity. If it's not authorized, then this court and the claims court treat it as a tort, and it's not available for recompense under the Tucker Act. So we have to examine the statute in this case to determine what is it that Congress authorized anybody to do under this statute. And what we find is that Congress authorized the conversion of abandoned railroad rights of way into recreational hiking and biking trails if that could be done without the expenditure of federal money unless Congress had specifically appropriated money for this program in advance of the acquisition. That's in Section 101 of this statute, and it is as clear an expression of a congressional attempt to control expense as I've ever seen.
Where will we find Section 101 of the statute? Do you have handy a ready citation to the appendix or somewhere?
If you don't... It's on page 18 of the Solicitor General's brief, Your
Honor.
Thank you. What the statute says, and I'll be happy to read it for the record and for the court, is notwithstanding any other provision of this Act, authority to enter into contracts and to make payments under this Act shall be effective only to such extent or in such amounts as are provided in advance in Appropriations Acts. What the intent of Congress was in doing this was to create essentially a voluntary program that would result in no liability to the federal government if voluntary agreements could be worked out among the parties that they thought were involved in these proceedings. The problem is that the way that the statute is set up, the way that the ICC administers it, the people who own the underlying fee interest in these rights of way are not even consulted, let alone brought into the picture.
Well, the Solicitor General, in his brief, right after having set forth that section, says that this is not sufficient to withdraw the Tucker Act remedy. The language now is saying any other provision of this act is a common provision in appropriation bills and is not the clear withdrawal of a Tucker Act remedy that we've required.
Your Honor, I recognize the Solicitor General has argued that position. It seems to me that what we need to do is to look at what this Court has done with similar provisions in the past and with congressional restrictions on expenditures. And the classic case is a case which is cited in the briefs called Huey versus United States, a case this Court decided sometime in the 20s, I believe, but was relied on by this Court in the Regional Rail Reorganization Act cases a decade ago to describe and illustrate what this Court meant by authorized congressional action. What happened in Huey was that the Congress had created the Civil Service Commission, authorized it to both exist and rent quarters, and then it appropriated a sum of money for it to rent those quarters. The Commission went out and rented quarters, but instead of renting $4,000 worth of space, like Congress had told it to do, the Commission had a $6,000 appetite. When the landlord accepted the rent from the Commission, didn't complain about it, never sued over the next couple of years to throw the Commission out of the space that wasn't being paid for, the landlord sued in the claims court and thought that he had either an implied contract from the government to pay for this extra space which was being occupied, or he had a constitutional claim for a taking of his property without payment of compensation. What this Court said was, analyzing it under the Tucker Act, when Congress said you can have $4,000 to rent space, that's what Congress meant. And Congress did not authorize the occupancy of any space beyond what $4,000 would buy. Therefore, the occupation of additional space by an agency of the federal government was unauthorized governmental activity and at best was a tort, but was not compensable in the claims court either as an implied contract or as a constitutional remedy for a taking of property by the government. This was not authorized governmental conduct. And as I said, when this Court decided the Regional Rail Reorganization Act cases a decade or so ago and examined some of the early precursors to this reorganization of the transportation statutes, it quoted from the Huey case with approval on just what is authorized governmental action.
Well, then if the
what
Corps
is not.
If I own some land with a stream flowing through it and the Corps of Engineers goes on that land and builds a dam and diverts the water, I don't have an inverse condemnation action if it turns out that action of the Corps of Engineers was not authorized by Congress?
Your Honor, that's what this Court has said, and candidly, I'm not all comfortable with some of those opinions, but I think that they are there, and as I say, as recently as the regional rail cases, this Court quotes that line of authority with approval, saying that it, in effect, has carved out a branch of actions which the Court says are not actions of the government, but are actions by government officials unauthorized by Congress, and the remedy for those actions is not in the claims court.
Well, in this case, the prohibition against expenditures of money may have referred to expenditures other than expenditures for takings, i.e. staff to negotiate these easements and so forth. I don't think you necessarily can construe the statute as applying only to payments for takings.
Justice Kennedy, I don't construe it only as applying to that. I construe it as applying across the board to takings as well as to all of the other
My point is the language, it seems to me, can be given some effect and still allow a Tucker Act claim.
Certainly it could be given some effect. I can't quarrel with that. But it seems to me that the statute as written doesn't lend itself to that sort of an interpretation. It's a broadly written statute, which it seems to me is a clear indication of what the slim legislative history in this case reflects, and that is that what Congress wanted to do was to create these trails if it could do so without spending money. If it had to spend money, I don't think Congress was interested in this program.
But what if we agree with the Solicitor General and think you do have a Tucker Act remedy? What do we do in this case? Affirm the judgment on a different ground?
Well, Justice O'Connor, I certainly think it would have to be with a very different approach than the one that the Second Circuit took, because what the Second Circuit said is that under no circumstances do we have a taking here which anybody could remedy. So that if the court were to agree that there is a Tucker Act remedy available here, there would certainly have to be some dealing with that issue and a clear expression from the court that that, in fact, is what the underlying fee property owners in these trail conversions are supposed to be doing.
We also don't know what the Vermont law is as yet, do we?
Well, it's been cited to the court, but there certainly has been no determination
right. In
this case. Both the ICC and the Second Circuit simply assumed that Mr. and Mrs. Presault had the interest that they claimed, that there would be an interference with it, but that it did not present a Fifth Amendment problem.
Suppose there's a property with a railroad easement on it and a reversion. The reversion to take effect when the easement is no longer used for railroad purposes. And the ICC says, we're pretty sure that this route will be used in 25 years, and therefore we do not allow an abandonment. Is that a taking of the property?
No, Your Honor. That's an entirely different situation. What we would have there, Justice Kennedy, is an application of the existing regulatory scheme as it is intended to operate, and as the fee owners underlying these rail easements understand it to operate. And that is that the ICC determines whether, in a particular case, abandonment of the right-of-way is appropriate. Please recall what we have in this case, however, is something which is wholly different. If the ICC decided there would be no abandonment, then the tracks, the ties, the bridges, the trestles, they all remain in place, and the railroad is responsible for maintaining them if it wants to hold on to that possibility of reactivating the rail line in 25 years. What we have in a Trails Act conversion is that the abandonment is, in fact, approved. What the ICC says is, we don't need this property for railroad use anymore. You may go forth, tear up the tracks.
Including future railroad use, based on what you've told us earlier that the statute requires.
The statute is very clear that the ICC, in authorizing abandonment, must consider whether there is any future railroad need for this property, and if it finds that there is, it must deny the abandonment. In this case, of course,
do railroads ever remove tracks and trestles and ties but keep the right-of-way because of the possibility of future use, i.e. they'd then lay down new, more modern tracks and so forth?
I suppose they could do that, Your Honor, and I'm sure in some cases that in fact happens. Whether it happens in cases where they owned only a right-of-way for railroad purposes, I sincerely doubt. I think where you have that situation, you would find it where the railroad had bought fee title to the right-of-way area and wanted to clear its tracks off. When the ICC authorizes abandonment, it authorizes full abandonment. When it authorizes a discontinuance of service, the tracks, ties, trestles, bridges all remain in place for reactivation. What we have here in this situation is somewhat of a different angle, because the railroad in question never asked anybody for permission to stop running along this route. They simply stopped 14 years ago, tore up the ties and tracks, and put them to other use. And when Mr. and Mrs. Presault decided that they had had enough and they wanted to clear their title to the land, and they went to the ICC to ask the ICC to declare a de facto abandonment here, the railroad stepped in and said, oh, yes, by the way, why don't you approve what we did 10 years ago? The situation is a little off the norm, factually, but all of those facts are really sort of only in broad brush in the record here, because no court has ever examined what the facts are in this case.
Mr. Berger, do you have any idea how expensive a pig in the poke this statute would have been if indeed it's to be interpreted the way the government says, as simply authorizing the taking of land, and we'll we'll pay the bill later when it's presented. Do you have any idea how much, money you're talking about for all these rights of ways?
I honestly don't, Justice Scalia. All I can tell you is that what the record does reflect is that approximately 3,000 miles of right-of-way are being abandoned every year, and that was one of the reasons why the trail organizations wanted to get Congress involved in this and why there was such a nationwide interest, because this is happening in many states around the country. But at 3,000 miles a year, some of this land is quite valuable. The case that's before the court today involves a right-of-way that runs essentially along a lakefront in Burlington, Vermont. It is quite expensive land.
What percentage of those, I'm sure you don't, what percentage contain a reversionary interest? Is that more common or more unusual?
It is the more common, as I understand what has happened in these cases, Your Honor. The railroads in many cases, in many states rather, including Vermont, were essentially forbidden either by statute or by case law from acquiring anything other than an easement for right-of-way purposes. And even where they weren't, they elected to acquire the lesser estate in the land, or the property owners at the time elected to retain some interest in case railroad usage should cease at some future point. That way they would be able to reclaim and reuse what was left. But it is a substantial problem if, in fact, there has to be payment, which gets us back into the skimpy legislative history of this program, where the Congressional Budget Office examined the Rails to Trails program and the other amendments to the Trails Act in 1983 and concluded, with the concurrence of the House committee that examined it, that the funding required for all of these amendments would be, in their words, insignificant. And I would suggest to you that almost any value you placed upon 3,000 miles of right-of-way every year is going to be something more than insignificant, even in the context of determining the federal budget. What we've got here is a program that could, in fact, result in substantial judgments. We have a statute whereby Congress said it didn't want to spend money unless it approved the expenditure of that money in advance in order to keep some control over what those potential federal expenditures might be.
I take it the Act would have substantial effect if it were confined to the cases in which the railroad does own the fee.
The Act, in fact, would have no application at all if it were confined to cases in which the railroad owns the fee, Justice Kennedy. It was designed to operate and needed to operate only in those situations where the railroad owned an easement subject to reversion. The point being, and the ICC's reports bear this out, that where the railroad owns fee title, the railroad has always been free to transfer its interest to a state or local government or a trail organization for any use that it wanted
to. But doesn't this statute set forth a policy to encourage the ICC to work with the railroads to do that?
The statute says it encourages the ICC to do that. In practice, what happens is that the ICC simply holds its abandonment hearings. If during the proceedings leading up to abandonment, some state or local government agency or a recognized trail group files papers with the ICC indicating an interest in acquiring the property to operate a trail on, then the ICC grants the railroad and that organization 180 days after the determination that abandonment is appropriate in order to see whether they can negotiate voluntarily any transfer of use to a recreational trail. The ICC has clearly said that its function in this process is purely ministerial, to provide this brief time period for negotiations, and if either of those parties to the negotiations, either the railroad or the trail proponents, on the other hand, do not voluntarily wish, for whatever reason, to consummate an agreement, the ICC has no authority to compel an agreement, or even, if you listen to their words, to lean very hard on people to convince them that that's what they ought to be doing. It's a purely ministerial ICC action to facilitate voluntary agreement between the railroads.
Whereas for this type of land, what? What does the ICC do?
That is the ICC's only role here, Your Honor.
Oh, well, in a reversionary situation.
Yes. What in a reversionary situation, Justice Scalia, what the ICC does is to first rule that the railroad may abandon the right-of-way, and then if some agency has indicated interest in transforming the right-of-way into a recreational trail, the ICC issues one of two documents, either what it calls a certificate of interim trail use or abandonment, or a notice of interim trail use or abandonment, grants the parties 180 days to negotiate, and if they reach agreement, then they reach agreement, and it's transformed into a recreational trail. If they don't reach agreement, then that certificate automatically, without further ICC action, transforms into a complete certificate of abandonment, and the railroad goes on its way.
In the fee situation, as opposed to the reversionary situation, does the commission show any interest in the consideration that the railroad might receive in connection with the transaction? I assume these must be fairly profitable for the railroad.
Justice Stevens, railroads, I'm sure, have thought this was a wonderful idea. They are, in the non-fee situation, in the easement situation, selling something that they were willing to simply walk away from.
In the non-fee reversionary situation, is consideration paid to the railroad by the trail people or the transferees?
In some cases, it is, Your Honor. In this case, since what we have is two government agencies, I'm not sure whether there was consideration paid. In the more standard situation, where you have a private railroad negotiating, the records are clear that the railroads are, in fact, being paid for the transfer of this interest, whereas the underlying fee owners are receiving nothing. If the court has further inquiry, I'd be happy to respond. Otherwise, Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Martin, we'll hear now from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. First, I would like to respond to Justice Kennedy's last question. The statute does apply and has meaning in the fee simple situation. And the railroad's incentive in that type of case would be to not abandon the railroad right of way, because once it is abandoned, the ICC grants a certificate of abandonment. If 20 years later the railroad wants to resume service, they would have to go through the initial application under 10903 of the Interstate Commerce Act for constructing a railroad and getting permission to run a railroad, which involves a more lengthy process. Under this scheme, if they resume service in the future, even in a fee simple situation, all they would have to do is notify the commission. So the statute applies to all railroad rights of way. It has incentives to apply in every type of situation. The court could affirm the decision of the ICC, and this is an action for judicial review, on any of three grounds. We urge the court to affirm on the Tucker Act ground that even if there is a taking, there is an available remedy for compensation, which is all the Constitution requires, and that remedy is the Tucker Act. The two other possible grounds would be under Vermont law, or as the Second Circuit held, the statute may never result in a taking in any conceivable case. We think it would be inappropriate to resolve the case under Vermont law for essentially three reasons. In the first place, the Commission did not look to Vermont law, did not resolve this case on the basis of Vermont law. And this is — no, it didn't. It held that the statute may never result in a taking in any case.
Well, it said until the ICC issues a certificate of abandonment, the railway property remains subject to the ICC's jurisdiction, and state law may not cause a reverter of the property. And it said the Vermont Supreme Court recognized this.
Right. The Vermont Supreme Court would not issue an opinion on the title as long as the ICC retained jurisdiction over the right-of-way if it had not issued.
There's no reverter until there's an abandonment. That's what it seems to me the Court of Appeals said.
Well, if it gave its views of Vermont law, if that's an interpretation of Vermont law, so be it. But the ICC did not rest its decision on Vermont.
I know, but we're reviewing the Court of Appeals.
Well, you're also reviewing a decision of an agency. This is an action for judicial review. And under SEC against Chenery, the Court generally confines its review to the explanation given by the agency for its decision. And the agency does not want to get into the business of deciding title questions under state law. The agency believes that the Tucker Act is available if there is a plausible or a compensable taking.
That may be so, but doesn't the Court of Appeals have power to review whether or not the ICC has the authority to refuse to issue a certificate of abandonment?
Certainly.
And so how do you go about that? Why did it have the authority to refuse to issue the certificate of abandonment?
I don't think there's any dispute in this case that the ICC acted in accordance with its authority under Section 8D of the Trails Act. Under that statute, the ICC...
But it refused to consider the constitutionality of it, I suppose.
It did... The ICC has expressed its opinion that it's constitutional because there's an available remedy, the Tucker Act, for compensation. It did not express an opinion on whether or not there is a taking in this particular case, mm-hmm. a taking of property. Whether or not there is, it's still constitutional because the government, the United States, will pay if you file and prove your case under the Tucker Act.
Under the Tucker Act, Mr. Martin, and whether it's available, how do you deal with the Huey case that is relied on by Mr. Berger?
The Huey stands for the proposition that the government's action must be authorized. Well, the ICC's decision is authorized. It's explicitly authorized by Section 8D of the Trails Act. Therefore, the question comes down to, is the Tucker Act available? If it is, then the United States will pay for the ICC's action. So it's another way to rephrase the central question, is the Tucker Act available?
Well, but the argument they make is that the amendments to the Appropriations Act withdraw that authority
exactly.
when there are no funds. How do mm-hmm. you deal with that?
Well, that's clearly their main argument is that Section 101 of the 1983 amendments is an unambiguous withdrawal of the Tucker Act remedy. And that's the test. The test under the regional rail cases in Monsanto is it must be an unambiguous withdrawal of the Tucker Act remedy.
Excuse me, you say the 1983 amendments?
Yes.
Amendments to the Trails Act?
To the Trails Act. The Trails Act was passed in 1968. 1983, they amended it with trails purposes and railroad purposes. So we're talking about Section 8D of the Trails Act, which was added by the 1983 amendments.
Yeah, but the whole program we're talking about here is a 1983 program, isn't that right?
The Rails to Trails program is a 1983 program.
So effectively, this provision is contained in the Act that we have before us,
That's right.
This provision is just not an amendment to that act that was adopted later.
No.
It's part and parcel of the whole package.
It's an uncodified provision of the 1983 amendments, and the 1983 amendments is the Rails to Trails scheme. Okay. It is not an unambiguous withdrawal of the Tucker Act remedy, however, for two reasons. The provision says that any payment under the 1983 amendments must be made in accordance with an appropriations law. We think, in the first place, that a payment under the Fifth Amendment for a takings claim would not be a payment under the 1983 amendments. The 1983 amendments have...
But it says authority to enter contracts shall be effective only to the extent or in such mm-hmm. amounts as are provided in advance by mm-hmm. appropriation.
The ICC has entered into no contract in this case. So the provision they're relying on is the authority to make payments. They're saying that the government has no authority to make a payment under the Tucker Act. We think that 101 has nothing to do with the Tucker Act. It has to do with payments made under the 1983 amendments. And those amendments did a lot of things. It designated new scenic trails, authorized expenditures for markers for trails, for acquisition of other lands. That's what 101 deals with. Also, 101 restates the constitutional command found in Article 1, Section 9. No payments may be made without an appropriation of Congress.
Suppose that we were to find that this act does affect a taking if there's a reversionary interest.
Mm-hmm.
And suppose that taking a reversionary interest amount to $20 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
Is it consistent with the congressional intent and with the purpose of this act for the government of the United States to argue that the claims court should dole out $20 million a year when the Congress thought it wouldn't cost a dime?
I think it is consistent, certainly under the principles for reconciling the Tucker Act and other statutes, as this court's announced in Monsanto. It's consistent for the following reasons. Well, let me first finish answering Justice O'Connor's question, which also applies to your question. Congress has appropriated money for takings. There's a permanent standing appropriation, 31 U.S.C. 1304, to pay inverse condemnation claims, to pay Tucker Act claims. We're informed maybe the United States pays perhaps $25 million a year for inverse condemnation claims under statutes such as the National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, mining statutes, various statutes, water project acts, agricultural statutes. In all those cases, Congress legislated against the background of the Tucker Act with the knowledge that takings claims would be resolved by the claims court. I think in 1983, Congress didn't focus on whether or not there would be a takings. That's why there's nothing in the legislative history. That's the same thing.
Congress also said in this act, in section 1247D, that interim use, the rail for trail interim use, shall not be treated for any rule of law as an abandonment of the use of such right-of-way for railroad purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that an attempt to foreclose any claim, even a Tucker Act claim?
No, that is an attempt to override state law. Which gives rise to plausible takings claims. Without that provision, once the railroad ceased operating an active railroad and turned it into a bike path, under
but
state
it
law,
seems
there might
like
be
a direct attempt to avoid exactly this situation of a potential Tucker Act claim for a take.
It was a direct attempt to make sure that there would be available bike paths. It's not a reference to the Tucker Act or available compensation. I don't think Congress thought about a take. And I don't know how many takings there will be. The statute's been in effect for 6 years. There's not been one claim filed under the Tucker Act in the claims court. If there are, I mean, many of these railroad rights-of-ways are held in fee. Others are held by easements broad enough to cover another use. And to answer your question earlier on, many state laws have developed to the point to encourage this type of conversion themselves. So there may be a state law taking. I don't know. There will not be a federal law taking. That's why we don't know how much the government would be liable in the claims court, but that's what the claims court's for, and that's what the judgment fund, the permanent appropriation, is for.
Mr. Morton, would you tell me what you think this provision does mean if it doesn't cover the situation of action taken under the Act which must be compensated for? What does the provision cover when it says, notwithstanding any other provision, authority to make payments under this Act shall be effective only to the extent in such amounts as are provided in advance in Appropriations Act? You mean to make payments that the Act names in dollar amounts? Are there payments that are named in the Act?
Yeah, yes. There are a number — this Act, the 1983 amendments, covered a number of areas. It designated new scenic trails, designated markers. It authorized expenditures. It gave money figures. It authorized amounts, but it was not an appropriations law.
It gave money figures for other purposes.
For other purposes, it gave money figures for acquiring certain trails as part of the national trail
system. So you read under this Act to mean to make payments in amounts specifically specified under this Act, not to make payments required under this Act. I mean, you'll agree that if there's a taking, the payment is required by reason of this Act, not by reason of the Tucker Act.
By reason of this Act and by reason of the Fifth Amendment.
Right.
I mean, it's probably more natural to say it's required by the Fifth Amendment than by this Act. That's the way the courts describe takings claims as founded upon the Constitution. But even if this 101 would apply to a takings claim, the requirement is an appropriations law. Now, in many cases, many expenditures under the Act, I don't know if the funds were appropriated to acquire all this land or to buy the scenic markers and the like. That requires a separate bill, of course. But there is an appropriation to pay for takings claims. So the two statutes can be read consistently. And the court need not struggle too much. And, of course, the test is there an unambiguous withdrawal?
Maybe the general test, but you know, the thing that puzzles me about this case is you have to wonder if Congress would have enacted this particular statute if they would have thought they were incurring
a potential
liability.
Exactly. We wondered about that, too. And Congress has a history of paying for this type of thing.
The statute seems to be structured in a way with this concept of railroad banking, which is somewhat artificial, I would think, because I guess most of these right-of-ways are not going to be used for future railroad. It looks like it was a device to avoid financial responsibility.
And it may work if state...
But I would think
if
it would
state
be...
laws, state law may have developed to the point where they defer to the ICC's abandonment authority, whatever that is.
Yeah, they might buy the Second Circuit's rationale.
Right, right.
But it would seem to me that it would be in the United States' interest to know as promptly as possible whether this would be considered a taking. And I understand the
this particular case would be considered...
Me? Whether, assuming there's a reversionary interest here, we don't really know that.
Right.
Because I understood the Second Circuit to say we don't reach that question. Mm-hmm. But if there were one, and this is kind of a test case for a whole lot of other cases, I understand you're arguing the law, but I would think that the United States would have a great interest in knowing as soon as possible whether they have this financial obligation.
Well, there's so many different hypothetical cases that resolving one particular case under Vermont law and under a particular right-of-way would not help the United States that much. A holding under the Tucker Act would. That would mean the ICC will continue its business and we would litigate takings claims in the claims court where we always do, and there we would examine the interest, we'd examine state law, we would examine the federal overlay and the like. So that's the interest of the United States. I wish we could know, resolve it all one in one case, but we don't think that we can. The Commerce Clause argument, I think, is just a variation of the
Well, you do
Fifth
agree
argument.
That state law ultimately will determine the extent and nature of the petitioner's interests?
I think in this case that's true. There are some rights of ways which are granted under federal statutes. The federal law would have something to say with it. And there's also possible argument that any interest acquired since 1983 would have been taken subject to mm-hmm. the federal statute we're talking about today.
But in this case,
I think that's
you
right.
would say Vermont law should mm-hmm. determine.
And that's right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Dunleavy, we'll hear now from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, on behalf of my client, the State of Vermont, and its fellow respondents, the City of Burlington and Vermont Railway, I urge this Court, in the event it finds petitioners taking claim ripe for review, to hold that the petitioners are not deprived of any property interest by Section 1247D. In essence, we submit to the Court that Section 1247D takes nothing and changes nothing.
The Court of Appeals.
We do, Your Honor. It leaves the petitioners just where they would be if the ICC had ordered the railroad to keep running.
Well, but that's like saying if my aunt were a man, she'd be my uncle. I mean, the ICC didn't order the railroad to keep running.
I'm saying the railroad could have continued using it for rail purposes, so you really haven't lost anything. In fact, they didn't, but they might have, even though you have a deed that says if we stop using it for rail purposes, it's yours. You say, well, you haven't lost anything because, yeah, they have stopped using it for rail purposes, but they might not have.
Well, we think
that's not very appealing to me.
We think, Your Honor, that the rail banking is itself a legitimate railroad regulatory function. I think one of the basic differences between our view and that taken by the petitioners in this case, they characterize the transactions by which these rights of ways were assembled just a series of private transactions. That is really at odds with the history of how the railroads were built. They were built and operated in an atmosphere of pervasive government regulation. The rights of way were assembled by public service corporations that had the power of eminent domain, certainly one of the most far-reaching powers that the government can delegate to a private corporation. Railroads, from the very beginning, it was understood that they would be regulated by governmental authority, either the states or, as has indeed in more recent years become predominant, the federal government.
We're talking as much here about the relationship between the railroad and the people from whom they bought the rights of way as we are between the railroads and the government, aren't we? The railroads did have to go out and condemn this property, and I guess some of them got fee interest and some of them got only easement.
Well, Your Honor, I think this goes to the point that, as was held by the Vermont Supreme Court in the Fitzgerald case in 1890 and by this court in Louisville and Nashville versus Motley in 1911, that when parties enter into transactions with a railroad corporation, which is subject to regulation by Congress under the Commerce Clause, those parties are chargeable with knowledge that that regulation can have an effect on the behavior of the railroad in the future.
That might be the law of the state of Vermont, in which case I suppose there would be no taking here. But certainly we can't speak for the law of 50 states on this subject.
Well, we would submit, Your Honor, that the Commerce Clause has always been there. Congress may not, it didn't establish the Interstate Commerce Commission until 1888. It didn't start to regulate abandonments until 1920. But when it did start to regulate abandonments in 1920, there were no grandfather clauses for railroads that were constructed prior to that time.
Yeah, but suppose that under a given state law, forget Vermont for a minute, under a given state law, the state would recognize a reversionary interest, despite the fact that the ICC had said, we're going to put this under rails for trails.
Then I think, Your Honor, that that particular...
Why isn't that a taking, then?
I think that particular state's policy would have to yield to the Supremacy Clause.
Well, I mean, why doesn't the policy have to yield to the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause? I just don't understand. If under state law a reversionary interest would be recognized and the federal government has somehow legislated and acted so as to take that reversionary interest, why isn't compensation?
The action of the federal government, although it could not obviously have been specifically predicted, is occurring in an atmosphere where the possibility of government regulation under the Commerce Clause has always existed.
Do you take the position that by acting under the Commerce Clause, the federal government can avoid always having any takings problem?
Not always, Your Honor.
Somebody in physical possession of the reversionary interest? There's no taking because it's under the Commerce Clause?
Not always, Your Honor. However, in a situation where we are talking about a railroad that was of indisputably interstate character from its very inception.
They can do it for railroads.
I think clearly they can.
That's an amazing argument.
What's your closest authority for this amazing argument in this court?
I think, Your Honor, the whole series of cases, first Colorado versus United States, in 1926, which recognized the seminal case on the ICC's abandonment authority. More recently, Chicago and Northwestern versus Kalo in 1981, the fact that ICC...
Those didn't really deal with a takings problem, did they? Those dealt with the authority of Congress to regulate the railroads.
They go to the issue of congressional authority under the Commerce Clause. I think some of the... Colorado versus U.S., I think was addressed to...
How about some of the navigational servitude cases?
Well, we would suggest to the court that that situation is strongly analogous.
There they do deal with the question of taking. They say under some circumstances what you had was not something that was really a property, right? So there was no taking.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think the rationale used there is that although... The state of title or the condition of title may vary from state to state and, in fact, may be unknown. What is clear is that the property interests of riparian owners were subject to a dominant public servitude from the beginning. And as long as the action of Congress takes place pursuant to that servitude, it does not result in a taking. And I might – this is not a rare situation. It's something that we encounter on a daily basis on Vermont. In Vermont, one of our principal state highways is U.S. Route 7, which was – sections of it were laid out in the 1790s, early 1800s. Obviously, the property owners involved in a condemnation in 1795 did not anticipate the presence of 80,000-pound motor trucks, power lines, fiber optic lines, sewers, guardrails. But they did understand that their land was being appropriated to a dominant public servitude and that the exact use of that would vary depending with changing public needs and also with actions of future governmental authority in regulating the use of that right.
So even though you say for railroad purposes, it doesn't mean for it means for any purposes. That's equivalent to giving a highway easement? Do you think your state could use those highway easements for amusement parks in the future?
Well,
I don't care whether it's a cart or a truck; it's still a highway. But how is that comparable to saying that when a property owner gives an easement, saying so long as it is used for railroad purposes, what does it mean if it doesn't mean so long as it is used for railroad purposes?
Well,
not for a bike trail or a hiking path.
Justice Scalia, I think there are two different issues there. One is, of course, the issue of Vermont law, which was not reached by the Second Circuit. It is, incidentally, our position that Vermont law, in effect, equates highways with railroads and permits a variety of public uses. But I think the point that is immediately presented in this case is the Commerce Clause regulation of railroads. And I don't think one needs to...
I don't doubt that when the person gives an easement, he knows that the federal government is going to determine the nature of that railroad, whether it can run, whether it can't run, whether the easement has to be abandoned. And I'll even be willing to concede, if you like, that he knows that the federal government might pass an act like this that says in the future that is going to be used for a bike path. But he doesn't know that in the future the ICC is going to be able to override the Fifth Amendment by saying in the future that's going to be used for a bike path even though we have no right to do it and we're not going to pay you. The issue here, is, it seems to me, is not whether the ICC has authority. Does anybody contest that the ICC has authority to do this if it wants to with payment? The only issue is whether it overrides the Fifth Amendment. And what case do you have that shows that the ICC can displace the Fifth Amendment?
Well, I think we don't argue that the Commerce Clause displaces the Fifth Amendment. I think the court's decisions on that are clear. However, as in the navigational servitude cases, if the governmental action that is being reviewed is occurring pursuant to a servitude to which the property has always been subject, there is no additional taking, even though the exact use of it may not have been specifically foreseen.
Well, I thought this property, the easement, was acquired many years ago for the purpose of putting on the railroad, that it required acquisition of the easement. Is that right?
The property was acquired in 1899 under condemnation powers that the Vermont legislature delegated to the railroad.
Exactly.
But, Justice O'Connor, the record in this case is illustrative. The statute provided that it was for a public use. The legislature reserved the right to pass amendatory legislation, and the general statutes in effect at that time even provided that the state could acquire the right-of-way for public ownership. So the idea, the rigid static approach...
Could acquire it for free?
Excuse me?
Could acquire it for free?
Acquire it from the railroad.
Without paying the railroad the value of what was taken?
No, they would have to pay the railroad, but they...
The takings clause would require that?
Yes, it would require that, the railroad. I think in conclusion, I would urge the court to hold that any ICC action under Section 1247D is not materially different from other types of ICC action affecting railroad abandonments. The only thing that is different here is that the Section 1247D shifts the burden of rail corridor preservation from the carriers to the trail sponsor. Congress could have taken the heavy-handed approach and said simply, we're going to preserve all rail corridors, and we're going to make the rail carriers bear the expense of that. But obviously they made the decision, and this is, of course, quite consistent with the general tenor of deregulation over the past few years, that they would not do that. And that, in effect, this is a subsidy that transfers the expense to the trail sponsors. It is, nonetheless, a railroad purpose. And the fact that the burden...
Are there any regulations or rules that tell the trail sponsor what kind of steps he must take to preserve it for rail purposes? Supposing they start building walls up and down and change it totally, there's nothing to prevent the rail sponsor from doing anything that would make it effective.
The statute requires them to maintain the right-of-way and to acknowledge that it's subject to resumption of railroad purposes. I don't think there's any specific regulation. In this particular instance, the lease requires them to maintain it, and the ICC acknowledged that fact in its decision. We submit that the rule urged by petitioners is not only impractical, but analytically unsound in that it ignores the role of federal regulation under the Commerce Clause as an integral part of the burden of railroading for which the petitioner's predecessors in interest were fully compensated in 1899. Thank you.
It's a curious evolution of federalism that a state would be before us arguing that under the Commerce Clause, the federal government can take property rights that a state could not itself take.
Well, contrary, Your Honor, to the petitioner's suggestion, I think the record is clear that they had heard of the Commerce Clause in Vermont in the 19th century. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Mr. Berger, do you have rebuttal? You have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to touch briefly on the question raised by the solicitor. We are seeking invalidation of the statute, Justice White. That is our belief that the statute as written cannot constitutionally stand.
And therefore, the ICC's decision has to be turned aside.
Both the Second Circuit and the ICC need to be reversed because they were operating under the assumption that this was a valid statute which authorized this sort of a transmogrification of private property into public property without even consulting the property owner.
But at some point, you can't win unless and until you show that some property's been that your client has a property interest.
Once that's done, Your Honor, that's correct. We're going to have to go back to court. My clients began this litigation, as the record shows, as a quiet title litigation in the Vermont state courts. Mm-hmm. They were unable to reach the merits of that action because the Vermont Supreme Court said you first have to get the ICC to sign off on its jurisdiction. So we came to the ICC to try to get the ICC to sign off, and what they did was to convert the property into a bike trail for the city of Burlington. If we can get the appropriate ruling from this court, which will free us of those constraints placed by both the Second Circuit and the ICC, then we'll be able to find out under Vermont law.
We wouldn't be facing any much of a problem here if it had been decided in Vermont that your client didn't have a property interest.
If they had reached that issue and made that decision, the case wouldn't be here. I'd have been sort of startled had they done that, given what I know of Vermont law.
So we don't really have to decide whether your client has a property interest or not.
I think, Your Honor, that's correct.
And so we don't have to decide Vermont law at all.
I don't believe that's here. What
for both purposes of this case, we assume that he has a property interest.
That is my understanding, Justice Scalia, of the posture of this case, that both the ICC and the Second Circuit made that assumption and based their rulings on the assumption.
Of course, we might want to avoid dealing with some of these issues by certifying the question to the Vermont Supreme Court.
If the court wished to take that action, of course, that
we could avoid all sorts of constitutional arguments.
Maybe, perhaps they would be delayed, Your Honor, rather than avoided, if that were done. And the
not if the Vermont court said there is no property interest here. The reversion doesn't ripen until there's an abandonment.
Well, that's where we were before, and that's why we need the ICC's ruling on whether there's an abandonment or not.
I know, but we still, if the Vermont Supreme Court said that no reversionary interest arises until there's until the ICC has issued a certificate of abandonment.
The ICC has effectively done that, Your Honor, subject only to this Trails Act conversion, which takes place after they decide that abandonment is appropriate. As they say, in every Trails Act case, they first decide that they don't need this property for railroad use. Then they reach that issue. So the ICC has reached that question.
Thank you, Mr. Berger.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 88-1400, Franchise Tax Board of California versus Alcan Aluminum Limited. Mr. Lattice, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This is a tax case, but where are the taxpayers? The domestic corporations that do business in California and that are assessed and pay the California taxes are not before this Court today. Counsel employed by those taxpayers are counsel of record here, and they are challenging the validity of the California tax. But today they are on the record as representing the taxpayers' sole stockholders, Alcan and Imperial, the foreign corporations which control the domestic taxpayer corporations. It is that control which has orchestrated these suits so that taxpayers are not before the court today. It is that control which should lead to the dismissal of these actions under the Tax Injunction Act. Most of the space in the briefs is taken up with discussions of the standing issues, but since the Tax Injunction Act provides its own plain, speedy, and efficient means of resolution of these cases, I will discuss the Tax Injunction Act first. For purposes of this part of the argument, it should be assumed that somehow the respondents have satisfied the Article III and prudential standing rules. If the taxpayer subsidiaries were before the court today in these federal actions, there is no question but that the Tax Injunction Act would apply to bar them from the federal courts and to point them back to the plain, speedy, and efficient remedies provided by the California courts. Recognizing that, respondents, the foreign corporation parents, have decided to hide the taxpayers under their parental skirts and take the federal field themselves. They have filed their actions in the Seventh Circuit, since the Ninth Circuit had denied relief to other foreign corporations, foreign parents.
Mr. Lash, does the California State Board have an office in Chicago? So there's personal jurisdiction, I take it.
There is an office there, and audits are conducted there, Your Honor. Not necessarily the audits in this case, but the audits are conducted there. Certainly Alcan would not be bringing this action in the Second Circuit because it had already been denied standing in that circuit to raise these sort of issues. But once they were in the federal courts and were confronted with the Tax Injunction Act, then they said, well, the Tax Injunction Act can't apply to us because we have no plain, speedy, or efficient remedies in the state courts.
Do they?
They do, in effect, have plain, speedy, and efficient remedies.
How?
Through the fact that they are the sole stockholders of the taxpayers.
You think the domestic subsidiary can raise the issues for them?
Certainly, Your Honor. The domestic subsidiaries are the taxpayers. They are the parties been assessed the tax. What's put an issue in
the... You think they can raise the Foreign Commerce Clause issues, the domestic subsidiary can?
It's only common sense that they can, and also it's if you look to what's going on in the California courts right now...
arguing against that.
Excuse me?
You wouldn't be arguing against that in
the
state
courts. Currently, there are cases pending in the California state courts where the issues are being raised by subsidiaries.
And what position is the state taking on those? Is
the state
saying, fine, we're going to litigate those issues?
The state is taking the issue as to some of them. The state is taking a procedural defense that they did not raise them in the claims for refund. But in no case is the state claiming that the subsidiaries cannot raise those foreign commerce claims. And we would be unsuccessful if we did try to raise
that
because...
the claim that it costs more.
Those claims are being fully litigated in the state courts. In one case, the Barclays case, I believe that's one of the issues where we are claiming that they did not raise that in the
their
claims for refund.
Do you think under California state tax law that the state could take the position that it can tax the parent, that the parent's the taxpayer?
Not under the California state law, Your Honor, and that...
Well, it reads broadly enough. I mean, you take the position you can tax all their income.
No, Your Honor, we do not.
Well, that you can consider worldwide income.
The California statute states that the taxpayer is a person subject to the tax. That doesn't get us anywhere except the section that does impose the tax, Section 23151 of the California Revenue and Taxation Code, says that it imposes the tax on every corporation doing business in the state. Now, in these cases, the corporations doing business in the state are the domestic subsidiary corporations. And those are the corporations, under the stipulations of fact, that the assessments have been made against. Those are the corporations that information has been requested from. And those are the corporations that we are determining what income should be attributed to their California business. Now, in determining that, California does turn to the income of the unitary business. And looks to the whole unitary business in order to make the apportionment. But the tax is levied on that corporate entity, and the Franchise Tax Board deals with that corporate entity in its tax procedures. In the container case, this court recognized that although California counts income arguably attributable to foreign corporations in calculating the taxable income of that domestic corporation, the legal incidence of the tax falls on that domestic corporation. And as a final touch, to consider if that corporation did not pay the tax, under California law, there was no means for us to go after the foreign parent corporation. It is that corporation that has the tax liability. And if that corporation goes insolvent, we must file claims in the bankruptcy of that corporation. But there are no provisions that's not really the taxpayer after all, and we can go after anyone else. So we submit that the foreign parents, having let their subsidiaries keep their California procedures lying fallow while going to the federal courts, that this is a form of forum shopping that strikes at the very heart of the federalism that Congress meant to preserve in the Tax Injunction Act. This forum shopping strips California of its tax remedies, which Congress meant to protect in the Tax Injunction Act, and subjects California to the expense and peril of litigating the ultimate constitutional validity of its tax structure, regardless of whether the tax has been paid against non-taxpayers in actions where California would not have the other procedural or other substantive defenses or issues it might raise against the taxpayer itself.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock, Mr. Ladd.
Thank you.
You may resume, Mr. Laddish.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. You will recall we left California confronting a challenge to its basic tax structure in a distant federal forum which has absolutely no familiarity with the procedural or substantive nature of California tax law. The threat that this might occur to other states has caused 39 amici states to join with California in asking this court to recognize this threat for what it is and give it the fate that it deserves under the Tax Injunction Act. The Tax Injunction Act has quite clear language to avoid such forum shopping as we see today. These shareholder corporations cannot get the declarative or injunctive relief that they seek where a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy may be had in the courts of the state. This court in the Grace Brethren case recognized that at the time of the Tax Injunction Act's enactment, Congress was well aware that tax refund procedures were the sole remedy offered in many states. And in the same case, this court recognized that California's tax refund remedy in a similar statute and another tax provided a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy. Under a very strict reading of the Tax Injunction Act language itself, this recognition would be enough to bar these suits, for at least some interpretation must be had given to the language to add the requirement that anyone other than the taxpayer have a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy. If a requirement were to be read into the statute that the party bringing the federal action must, in effect, have a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy in the California courts, that requirement would be met here. In order to protect the state's finances, the state of California offers its remedy in the usual tax refund form. This is, by its form, limited to the taxpayers. That limitation, though reasonable by itself, could arguably lead to inapplicability of the Tax Injunction Act if the parties before the court, the federal court, only could rely upon the hope of persuading the taxpayers in the state courts to raise certain issues or to raise them in a certain way. But that is not the case before the court today. Here we have the sole stockholders of the taxpayers in California, and those stockholders do not need to rely upon the hope of persuasion. They have the certainty of control. The result of barring these actions under the Tax Injunction Act is not only consistent with the language, it is fully consistent with the purpose underlying the Act, which was to limit drastically federal court jurisdiction to interfere with the lifeblood, intense local concern of the states in the assessment and collection of their own state taxes. In furtherance of this purpose, this court in the Grace Brethren Church case recognized that the plain, speedy, and efficient remedy should be construed narrowly. Now, in further answer to the question as to whether the taxpayer's remedy itself encompasses the ability to raise all the Foreign Commerce Clause issues, I submit that if, upon reflection, any other result would be absurd. The issue before the court today is the constitutionality of the California tax. That tax is imposed upon the domestic corporation subsidiaries. If the tax is invalid, the subsidiary would not be liable for that tax. And it only stands to reason, as common sense, that the subsidiary necessarily has standing to raise any question going to its own tax liability. When we move to the standing issue, the subsidiary taxpayer's ability to raise all the issues pertaining to the validity of its tax is also central in the application of the dispositive rule here, the stockholder standing rule. Under the stockholder standing rule, a stockholder will not have standing to litigate an issue if the stockholder's injury is derived from its status as a stockholder and if the corporation itself would have standing to raise the same issue. Assuming arguendo for the moment that there is Article III standing here, which I'll be dealing with in a moment, clearly the stockholder standing rule would apply under the facts of this case as a prudential rule of standing.
May I give you a hypothetical case that we've been thinking about? Supposing the subsidiary's tax would be the same, whether you use the unitary business approach or you could somehow or other isolate them if they claimed it was unconstitutional, but it really didn't make any difference in the tax obligation of the subsidiary, and therefore, arguably, it wouldn't have standing to raise all sorts of constitutional issues. Might it nevertheless be true that in such a case, the state's insistence on following the unitary approach would pose a lot of burdens on your adversaries here that were not imposed on the taxpayer, and that there'd be no forum in which that particular claim could be litigated?
Well, still, if as to the validity of the tax, I believe, since California is not only taxing the corporation that's doing business in California, it is asking that corporation for all the information pertaining to the assessment of the tax. Why, it is that corporation that has the direct request or demand made upon it by the Franchise Tax Board, and that corporation would have the standing still to challenge if we're talking about whether the tax is valid because of administrative burdens.
Even if it wouldn't affect its tax liability?
I believe so, Your Honor, because it would still be, as is the situation in the litigation in the California courts today, that's one of the grounds that is being raised, and that ground itself, I think, is based on a cost factor. And so it's more than just an idle question as to there would be a case in controversy as to whether or not this corporation would need to supply the information or undergo the penalties for failing to supply the information. The stockholder standing rule here clearly applies because all of the injuries flow to, if there are injuries here, they flow to the respondents here because of their stockholder status. And I think a hypothetical would make this clear. If Alcan, say, were not a stockholder in its domestic subsidiary, in other words, Alcan and Alcan Corp. have absolutely no stockholder relationship, but California somehow didn't get the word and still assessed a tax on Alcan Corp., taking into account all of Alcan's income and asking Alcan Corp. for a considerable amount of information about Alcan. Alcan, not being a stockholder, could just sit by and see how it all comes out if it's even interested in finding out, but there would be absolutely no economic detriment to Alcan. All of the injuries that are alleged in this case and that are found by the Seventh Circuit flow from the stockholder standing, from the stockholder status. Just as clearly, as I mentioned before, pure common sense says that the corporation itself would have standing to raise all of the issues that are being meant to be raised in today by the respondents. And I point out that the Grace Brethren Church case, again, in looking at a similar California tax refund statute for another tax, particularly recognized that the taxpayer there could raise all the arguments pertaining to the validity of the tax. Respondents have not come forward with any policy reasons justifying the departure, any departure from the use of the stockholder standing rule as a prudential rule of standing. To the contrary, there are strong policy reasons supporting the application of the rule in this case.
Well, the Seventh Circuit found, didn't it, Mr. Lazier, if perhaps found isn't the right word, maybe held, that the corporations here that did sustain a different kind of injury from the taxpayer.
The Seventh Circuit, Your Honor, I've mixed the merits with the standing issue. When considering the standing issue, forgot to consider the strong issues of federalism that we can maintain underlie both the standing issue and the Tax Injunction Act issue in this case, and did find this injury that was really, as I understand it, would be, gee, there's a good chance that foreign commerce is being interfered with here, and these people are in foreign commerce, and therefore we will find an injury where we might not otherwise find. It's submitted that that injury is not cognizable standing injury, even under Article 3 standards. It certainly would fit under the stockholder standing rule. Without the stockholder link, there would be no standing. And certainly, I think it could be raised by the taxpayer corporation as a violation of the Foreign Commerce Clause. But under Article 3 standing, when boiled down to its essence, that injury, as found by the Seventh Circuit, is really that if a state imposes any tax upon a subsidiary, why then that the subsidiary's parent, whether it's in interstate or foreign commerce, would feel this burden upon its decision-making as to whether to do business in that state through the use of a subsidiary. It's submitted that that's basically saying corporations don't like standing. And to borrow a term from First Amendment cases, if you impose a tax on a corporation and its parent is doing business in interstate or foreign commerce, that is a chilling effect on interstate and foreign commerce. And it's submitted that an analogous approach was taken in Meese versus Keene, a 1987 First Amendment case of this court, which found that, or noted that, such arguments of a subjective chill would not be cognizable injury. Moving back to the stockholder standing rule itself, this court in Hawes v. Oakland more than 100 years ago decided that it was perfectly appropriate to apply the stockholder standing rule to prevent forum shopping through the abuse of federal diversity jurisdiction. And then in 1945, this court in the Shenley Corporation case held that it was particularly appropriate to apply the stockholder standing rule when there was a situation where you had a sole stockholder, since that sole stockholder could control the litigation of its subsidiary, precisely the situation we have today. The facts of today's case and the forum shopping aspects of it that I described earlier, and the combination of these policy currents that we have seen from prior cases, show that the stockholder standing rule as applied in this case certainly would not be an anachronism. It is supported, that application would be supported by the same concerns that underlay the Tax Injunction Act itself, the basic principles of federalism, which recognize the imperative need of the state to administer its own fiscal operations regarding its own taxes. Now, a somewhat closer question comes up when we talk about whether Alcan and Imperial have Article 3 standing. I've already discussed the Seventh Circuit's found injury that Alcan and Imperial didn't know they had until the Seventh Circuit pointed out to them. But as to the injuries that they assert as far as the standard double taxation injuries and cost of compliance injuries that they assert, I would point out that there is, although the rule may be different in other areas, when a party is challenging the validity of a statute, federal or state, in order to establish a distinct and palpable injury to himself, that party must demonstrate a realistic danger of sustaining a direct injury as a result of the statute's operation or enforcement. That rule was most recently stated in the case of Pennell versus City of San Jose in 1988. That rule would apply to the facts of this case in that the only actions by the Franchise Tax Board were taken as against the stockholder, as against the subsidiary corporation, the California taxpayer in this case. And any effect of those actions would be indirect upon the respondent. As to Imperial's argument that if its United States subsidiary had issued any dividends, why then a double taxation injury would have occurred to Imperial because of the United Kingdom statutes having to do with dividend credits. We submit that that purported injury would fail for two reasons. Number one, it's hypothetical. There never were any such dividends. We don't know exactly what would happen when that occurred, and the only source for determining that is an affidavit where the United Kingdom person giving the affidavit was not was very forthright in saying he wasn't entirely certain what would happen under the law. But the second reason that that injury should be rejected is that under this court's decision in Warth v. Selden, the line of causation that has to do with the requirement, Article 3 requirement, that the injury must be fairly traced to the actions of the defendant, that line of causation would be broken by any intervening acts of the tax authorities. In this case, it would be the United Kingdom tax authorities. Franchise Tax Board is in full agreement with Imperial in one respect, and that is that Alcan is wrong when it argues that this court must decide the ultimate constitutional merits of this case in order to decide the standing issue. This court barely 6 months ago in Asarco Incorporated versus Kadish stated the established rule that federal standing in no way depends on the merits of the claim. And this certainly makes sense in the Foreign Commerce Clause area, where you might have an undoubted injury. I'll give you a hypothetical example. A party may be subjected to the same injury that the taxpayer in Japan line felt, a double taxation injury, and yet upon analysis, this court might find that Congress had taken the same line of actions as was taken in the case of Ward Air Canada versus Florida Department of Revenue. In that case, this court decided that Congress, through its actions, had indicated that the states could tax as they please in a particular area, and Congress, being in control of foreign commerce, not the executive, would have control, and that would not be a violation of the Foreign Commerce Clause, even though the taxpayer might have an injury that, in Japan line, led to a decision in its favor in the merits. Moving to the question as to what effect does the pleadings have in the on the standing issue in this case, if standing was being decided at the pleading stage, by non-speculative allegations of the complaint, certainly would be binding on the standing issue. But here we have stipulations of fact which have superseded the complaints in many respects.
Well, if there's no standing, do we ever reach the Tax Injunction Act?
If there's no standing, there's no need to reach the Tax Injunction
Act. No need, but can we?
I believe this court can assume standing.
Assume it?
And reach the Tax Injunction Act.
And reach the, and say, and dismiss the case on the...
Even if there were standing, why the Tax Injunction Act would apply. I believe so, Your Honor.
Would that be true if there were no Article 3 standing?
I believe the court could take that approach. I believe the court has at times decided that that it would not reach a particular issue because another issue would apply even if no matter what it decided on the first
issue. Even where that issue is a standing issue? I mean, that's sort of remarkable. We can decide all sorts of things, though, where there's no standing. So long as we decide them against the person who asserts standing, we can reach all sorts of issues.
I would be perfectly happy, Your Honor, if you decided for me on the standing issue and left the Tax Injunction Act issue alone. I wanted to argue that
I always thought we had to resolve standing issues before we got to other issues.
That certainly makes practical sense to me, and I believe
that is very impractical.
Leave that in your hands.
You just wanted to make sure to get the Tax Injunction Act argued before you ran out of time.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. Also, we should point out that the allegations of the complaint should not be irrefutable for standing purposes when they are indeed matters of law. As an example, Alcan's complaint, paragraph 17 of page 10 of the Joint Appendix, says that since California is using worldwide unitary income as its base, it is therefore imposing a tax upon Alcan. There's no sense to bind California to that for standing purposes when just last term, in Shell Oil Company versus Iowa Department of Revenue, this court decided that the mere inclusion of income in the pre-apportionment tax base does not by itself constitute taxation of that income. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time if I could.
Thank you, Mr. Laddick. Mr. Salibra?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I represent two foreign parents, Alcan Aluminium Limited and Imperial PLC. They have some common characteristics that give rise to this litigation that I think are important to consider. First is they are foreign parents and do not operate in the United States. They have no permanent establishment in the United States, as that term is generally recognized, tax area. They operate exclusively in the U.S. through subsidiaries. Both are assessed by California on the worldwide combined apportionment method, and both, in their view, feel that as a result of that assessment, the promises made to their government that when they invested in the United States through a subsidiary, they would have no impact on their operations outside of the United States, except as derived from the shareholder status, is being, in fact, undermined by the California tax. We see this case not as a Tax Injunction Act case, but as a shareholder case. Is this tax treating us like a mere shareholder or a passive investor? It came up out of the district court in that way. Judge Williams ruled that we had no right to pursue this case because the only possible injury we could have is the injury derived from a passive shareholder investor. We think that's incorrect. We think, and we agree with the Seventh Circuit, then when you look at this case and you look at the impact of the tax, it is the fact that we are not being treated like a shareholder which gives rise to our right to standing and gives rise simultaneously to our objection to the tax on constitutional grounds.
You're not being treated at all by California.
On the contrary, Justice Scalia, we are in fact being treated as though we, in fact, were operating in the United States as a permanent establishment.
You don't get any bill from California, do you?
We get a bill from California in this sense. California says there is a single unitary business. It's operating in our state. We want to determine what income is available to it. We've determined that based on that worldwide operation, and we're sending that bill to that portion of the unitary business that's in our state. Do they send it to Alcan Aluminium? No. Is there real worldwide impact from the tax? Yes. I think the most telling example that probably answers your question perhaps more directly than whether we get a bill is the example I used in the brief concerning the impact on a totally independent operation halfway around the world. If there is a business manager in the Alcan facility in India.
Can I interrupt before you go with
that? Yes, you may.
Are you assuming this totally independent operation is part of the unitary business?
I am, Your Honor.
Then it's not totally independent.
Well, it is not. It is part of the unitary business. That's right. It is not totally independent. That may be a wrong theory. It is part of the business. It is operating in India. As it operates, the business manager of that facility decides that some employees are retiring, and he can do two things.
He can not replace those employees and maintain the same productivity level. And he cannot replace, he can actually change the process and eliminate some of his capital equipment. The result of that plant decision is California tax goes up. That's where the impact is.
Why is that true? The total income goes up, but isn't it also true that the percentage of the business done in California goes down?
No, I didn't say that. The tax goes up, I'm sorry. The tax goes up. The California tax goes up.
Well, does it?
Because the income,
gross income goes up.
No, the total income stays the same. He's making his same level of productivity. He's produced the same amount of goods are produced now as they were before. All that's happened is he's reduced his payroll and he's reduced his property factors.
Oh, I see.
Fewer people, same income. California tax goes up. He's made a limited operational decision, a plant decision in India, and California tax goes up. And that is the impact. That's what they're doing to us. That is the cause of concern. And I might add, Justice Scalia.
Yes, like a little different. You present these arguments to the Court of Appeals?
Oh, yes.
Are you arguing standing now?
Yes, and I am arguing why that.
Did they agree with you?
I believe they did. They ruled in our favor.
Well, I know. I thought they invented another sort of.
Well, I take issue with the fact that they invented that, Your Honor. In fact, I'd like to get to the point.
That's
I will.
That's fine. I'm sorry.
We did argue this because you have to understand the impact of the tax to understand the nature of our claim. Okay, our claim is that none of these impacts would have been visited upon us, nor was there expectation when we invested in the United States through a subsidiary vehicle, if in fact the understanding between our governments had been observed. Now,
that goes to the merits of the question, doesn't it, Mr. Slavin?
Well, I think it does not, and let me just answer that by looking at what the Seventh Circuit said. The issue is whether or not the choice that we made, that is, are we simply here seeing some economic impact, or is there some decision that is uniquely our decision that has been infringed? What the Seventh Circuit said is, in the context of the unitary tax, what happens is there is a fundamental choice that needs to be made by foreign operations who wish to invest in international commerce. They have three options. They can either, one, operate in the other foreign company directly. They can, two, operate via a subsidiary. Or, three, they can operate by contract. Different tax considerations, different business considerations are associated with each choice. The foreign investor looks at the options, makes the decision. What the Seventh Circuit said is that in the context of aluminum and Imperial, the California tax takes away one of the options. There was an agreement between nations that we would have three options. California takes away one of the options.
But whether they're options or not depends on the merits, doesn't it?
Well, I agree with you. This is the point we made in our brief. It is impossible to determine, okay, to review whether we're being affected by the tax as a shareholder or independently without, in fact, addressing the merits. I think it is possible to determine that there is sufficient injury, as the Seventh Circuit did, and say there's sufficient injury, but we have not determined whether that injury is elevated to the level that constitutes a constitutional violation. However, if there is a determination that there is no injury, I think you were forced to the conclusion that there's no constitutional burden. That is, in fact, what the Second Circuit did in our case. It decided, I think incorrectly, and we can all agree, that Mobile decided the constitutional issue with respect to worldwide combined apportionment applied in the foreign parent context. It said so specifically. And then it decided, because of that, there is no injury and there can be no standing, because any injury that Alcan would see or Imperial would see would be derived solely through their status as a shareholder. Here the Seventh Circuit recognized that there is a direct injury, a choice of how you will invest, how you will conduct foreign commerce, and that choice is a choice that only the foreign parent can make.
Seems to me that would give shareholders standing in connection with wholly owned subsidiaries in an awful lot of areas. If that's a valid principle, it seems to me hard to limit it to foreign commerce considerations.
Well,
presumably domestic sole owners may have considerations and options as to what they're going to do. And I don't see how you can ever limit that to foreign commerce.
I can understand that concern. I can assure you, Justice Rehnquist, that it doesn't exist. And the reason is simple. The tax... I understand that. I'm going to try to explain why that
shouldn't
exist, yes. It shouldn't exist because the nature of the unitary method of taxation is such that what it does is it ignores the concept of the subsidiary in assessing the tax. It says there is one business. Okay? It's operating just like a single entity, and therefore we're going to compute the tax in effect like it's a single entity. There are no other shareholder, sole shareholder cases that would fall within that doctrine unless they were unitary.
Yeah, but what if the parent, instead of being an English or Canadian corporation, was a New York corporation and had subsidiaries all over the United States and maybe one or two in Canada?
And to the extent that it was unitary, one could argue that at least with respect to the unitary issue, it would apply. The Seventh Circuit said, we think that standing in this case and that the shareholder rule in this case differs to the extent that there is the condition in addition that we impose that it be both unitary and that that impact be on foreign commerce because the choice...
New York Corporation might want to build a plant in India, too. And its decision might be affected by how much they pay for things and all the rest, isn't it?
I apologize. I'm missing the...
I'm assuming that the parent is not a foreign...
Parent?
Not a non-United States corporation, but is a New York corporation.
Okay.
Has hundreds of subsidiaries, a few of which may be in India or Great Britain.
Okay.
Why isn't your principle applicable to that company?
Why wouldn't... Let me just see if I understand this. Why wouldn't an American company investing in India have standing to challenge a unitary tax independently because the California tax is affecting
its investment decision in India?
Well, I guess what I don't understand is what level of protection exists. Here, the level of protection,
well,
the issue...
Well, the statute basically unconstitutional, as I understand
it. Well, no. See, I think that's where we disagree. I think the point that we're making is that the injury that we're alleging is an agreement between our nation, Canada, the U.K., an agreement between our nation and the United States as to how we will be treated. I don't see in your example...
You rely on it basically on the treaty?
The agreement of the kind... I think the answer to that is that there are two levels. The first level are there are treaties that express the fundamental concept. Canada refers to it in its amicus brief that investments in the United States will not result in taxation beyond the shareholder role, except
if you accept the theory of the unitary tax, it doesn't. The only thing that's being taxed is the subsidiary. You just measure the tax by its percentage of the total business.
Well, once again, what I'm saying is I understand if you accept the philosophy, but I think your example is why doesn't the U.S. have a standing and a claim? And the answer is there's no alleged foreign commerce injury.
Well, it's a foreign commerce injury, but not a treaty violation.
Well, there's no foreign commerce.
Boiled down to special standing because you claim a treaty violation?
Well, because we claim that there is a violation of an understanding between the United States, a course of conduct, exemplified in some treaties and exemplified in the fact that there is a common understanding among nations, recognized by this court in Container, that international transactions will be evaluated under Section 42 arm's length standards.
So something to do with the merits confers standing.
Something to do with the merits confers standing to the extent that, yes, it is true, there must be a foreign commerce injury.
We're only going to apply this where foreign commerce is involved. But logically, why should it be limited? What is peculiar about foreign commerce to this particular question of standing, other than the arguments on the merits?
Well, my analysis of that would be very simply that it,
that one could, I think, make the argument that you're suggesting. When you unitize a company with its subsidiary, regardless of whether it's a foreign unity or an a U.S. unity, the shareholder role no longer exists. The shareholder role has been defeated because he's not being treated like a shareholder. He's being treated like one common element of a single business. I think that's what you're saying. You're saying, why should you add in addition to that? Am I correct?
I asked you a question.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not clear. The question is, why is it tied to the merits?
Well, yes. You said the Seventh Circuit says we won't apply this except in the area of foreign commerce. But I don't see anything there that would logically limit that principle to foreign commerce, other than something to do with these treaties you're talking about, which are basically questions of the merits.
Well, Your Honor, I don't disagree with that. I guess I'm saying I agree with you. They limit it to foreign commerce. I think it is logically possible to say whenever the shareholder role has been eliminated, whenever the shareholder isn't being treated like a shareholder any longer, then one is precluded from coming in when he wants to vindicate a right and say, you can't come in because you're a shareholder. I agree with that. That's not what the Seventh Circuit said. It said there were reasons why it was limiting it to foreign commerce. But I agree that to the extent that a shareholder is suffering an injury that is not derivative through his role as a shareholder, he should have a right of action, is in fact the fundamental principle that all of us recognize. I agree with that. There's established law on that principle that shareholders who suffer injury, Schaefer versus Universal Rundle, the shareholders who suffer injury, and that injury is not injury that derives from their shareholder position, but is unique and personal to them, have a right of action. And I agree that that is a rational position. The important point, I think, in this case, from the point of view of the foreign parents, is that, as I said, is that in this case, once you decide we are not a shareholder, or I'm sorry, that we are a shareholder, and that's the only derivative impact we see from the unitary method of taxation, the ability for us to go in and say this tax affects us in a way that violates the Foreign Commerce Clause requirements is, in our view, lost. We can't make it anymore.
Well, I thought I understood counsel for the state to say that the argument can be raised in state court by the domestic subsidiary.
Well,
I asked specifically about that and was informed, yes, it can be litigated in state court. Now, if that's true, why isn't that sufficient?
Well, I don't believe that is true. I think the issue is if there is a determination by this court that the worldwide combined apportionment method, as it applies to foreign parents in this case, treats them just like a shareholder with no other impact, just derivative shareholder impact.
Suppose the holding here is you don't have standing. You don't have shareholder standing.
Then I believe.
Now they say you can litigate, that the domestic subsidiary can litigate your concerns about the unitary tax scheme in state court.
And my answer to that is you have determined the merits. There is nothing to litigate. We would go in and we would say the unitary method of taxation is imposing an unconstitutional burden upon us. The court would say, what is that burden? The Supreme Court has determined that the only impact that this tax on you
So has, you're telling me that if we find you, your clients have no standing, that you're going to give up any attempt to go to state court and have the domestic subsidiary raise that argument. We're finished.
I am saying that if you hold that there is no injury beyond the injury of a normal shareholder, I don't see what claim we could make.
The state is quite willing to assume you do have standing. And then it says, go ahead, and but nevertheless, the Tax Injunction Act applies, and you must go to the state remedies.
It says we do have standing.
Well, it says they're willing to assume to have. They started out arguing the Tax Injunction Act, well, saying let's assume that there is standing, and nevertheless, the Tax Injunction Act bars going forward to this suit in the Seventh Circuit.
And we would disagree. It doesn't bar that. The Tax Injunction Act applies, and the principle of comity applies when there is a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy. And there is no plain, speedy,
and efficient remedy. Why not? The state says that these very issues, even though you have standing, these very issues can be litigated in the state courts.
And our answer is the fact that assuming the issues could be litigated, the Tax Injunction Act still wouldn't apply.
Why not?
And it wouldn't apply because of the uniform recognition of this court and those courts, every court in this case, which applied that doctrine, that absent the plain, speedy, and efficient remedy, the fact that there may be similarities of claims does not bar the action of another party without a remedy.
Why should anybody but the taxpayer have a speedy remedy?
For this very same reason the Ninth Circuit recognized a direct and immediate injury to the foreign parent.
Well, the foreign parent then can litigate it through the sub.
Well, I think what we're speaking of is whether that is in fact a principle under the Tax Injunction Act and an intention of Congress. And I think this Court has interpreted that and stated clearly that the fact that another party has a remedy.
Well, but the other party is the actual taxpayer. You, as Justice Scalia says, your client isn't getting any bill from the California state tax.
No, but our client...
Wait a minute.
I apologize.
It's only the domestic subsidiary, which your client owns, that gets the bill from the state tax commission. And the state says that domestic subsidiary can litigate all the foreign commerce issues it wants to in the California proceeding.
Well, that brings me, I am not convinced they can do that. I believe that the foreign commerce issue, which is the right we have to select the remedy, is a remedy that we can only argue. California, I don't think, the Alcancor, I don't think, can come in and say, we are here litigating the fact that our parent, Aluminium, is being deprived of its choices of how it wants to operate.
Well, that's what the Seventh Circuit cooked up. But I mean the ordinary foreign commerce rule, that the tax on the domestic subsidiary on a unitary basis violates the Foreign Commerce Clause.
Well, I think it's incorrect to say that they had cooked it up. I think what they had said was there is a unique issue. Yeah. I think they recognize that there is a unique injury here to Alcan, that injury is a injury that we have to evaluate in terms of how we're going to make an investment.
You said that there wasn't a plain and speedy remedy.
That's uncontested, Your Honor.
What do you mean it's uncontested?
California, they asked California quite directly, is there a remedy for Alcan?
Oh, I just heard the state say that... That you have a plain and speedy remedy through your subsidiary.
And our response to that is...
And I think if this case had come from the Ninth Circuit, I might say we ought to give some credence to their holding that there is no such a remedy. But, gee, this is the Seventh Circuit. What do they know about California law?
Well, I think the answer is there was a question posed to California, is there a remedy for Alcan? And the answer was... No, there is no remedy.
Not for the parent.
Not for the parent.
I mean, they can't go in there and litigate themselves.
That's
but
correct.
They can litigate through their subsidiary. They own it.
But that was exactly the issue, Your Honor, that they litigated in EMI 1 in the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit said the same thing that the Seventh Circuit said. There is no plain and speedy remedy for EMI. Capital may have a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy. But EMI doesn't, and therefore the Tax Injunction Act and its policies don't apply.
But that makes the judgment, which we can certainly review here, that a remedy for the sub does not amount to a remedy for the principal corporation. And if we say that's wrong, then we just say you know. Both the Seventh and the Ninth have been wrong.
That's correct. That's correct. You can say that. But I think it's incorrect to say that the Ninth Circuit held differently.
That point, the Ninth Circuit isn't describing California law. It is not saying that California will not let the sub raise Alcan's claims. What it is saying is that even if the sub can raise Alcan's claims, that's not enough.
And that's our position. That isn't enough.
Okay.
That's precisely
But that point is not a point of California law. It's
that's
a
right.
point.
It's a point of U.S. law, which I think is well established. There is not, in our view and in the Seventh Circuit's review, any dispute about that. Nor is there a dispute by any court that has ever reviewed that issue. And that's why the doctrine doesn't apply.
If we assume that your subsidiary can raise every question that you want raised there, and you can direct how they do it and who they hire to press it, I can't imagine why that isn't a plain and speedy remedy for the parent.
If we were to, if Alcan Corps would just be the surrogate, is that what you're saying?
Sure.
That we would go under their name and we would, in fact, try the case?
Well, that's what you will, that's what...
Yeah, that's what you're saying.
That's what's going to happen.
And I
anyway.
Think, well, I think once again, I'm going to do it very quickly. Once
Probably
again,
what's happening yeah, now.
I think the answer to that is once again, you assume that they can raise all, that when this case is adjudicated and resolved in California, they can resolve all the claims. I don't think that is true.
Yeah, but let's assume it is. Just assume it is.
Okay, I assume.
Then how about the Tax Injunction Act?
That still doesn't apply.
Why not?
And it doesn't apply because of the continued holding.
Because you mean that
you're saying, is there a policy reason why it shouldn't apply?
You mean because there is no way that the parent itself can file for a refund?
No. There's no remedy for itself, right? I think you can either file for a refund or you can, as the Ninth Circuit suggested, permit them to have access to the court indirectly through the same procedure that the.
Mr. Saliba, can you tell me a specific argument that you think you can make to Judge Williams in Chicago that you cannot make in California?
Yes. That I couldn't make in California?
You could not. One you could make to Judge Williams, but not to the California forum.
Well, yes, I would argue that I think that I could argue to Judge Williams that the burden that we are litigating here is the impact on our Alcan Aluminium's ability to conduct its foreign commerce through the vehicles that there has been an agreement were available to them. California has preempted that.
But why? How do you know you can't make that argument in California?
I believe we cannot make that argument in California because California would say that argument is not an argument for Alcan to make. You are not the right party. The right party, the real party in interest, the injured party, with respect to that claim, is not here.
Well, they can't say that.
Can you make it through the sub? I thought.
Make it through the sub.
Through
the sub make it on the ground. You, California, are treating the sub and the parent as a unitary business. This is an injury to the unitary business, which happens to impact directly on the parent, which I can describe to you. Ergo, I want to make the argument.
Can it be
made?
You're
telling me California won't listen to it.
Can it be?
It's inconsistent with their posture that you're all one business.
Well, I understand that, but if you assume that we're all one business, then we should be able to come in anyway.
You should be able to make any argument that would tend to show that the California procedures are unconstitutional,
Your Honor,
in the California forum.
We could make it. I think there is a serious risk that they will say,
"Well, there's always
you're wrong. You're not the right party."
Well, maybe you can read back to the person making that argument the transcript of the oral argument today. Mr. Laddish conceded that you could.
Well, it's interesting. I guess my response to that, Justice O'Connor, is that courts sometimes have decide that regardless of what the other side concedes, they're going to apply the doctrine as they see it and as appropriate. In fact, the entire standing issue that we're discussing here today was raised not by California.
That determination in itself would result in a judgment from the state court that could be reviewable here.
That would be true.
Yes.
That would be true. We're trying to avoid, however, coming back too many times. I'd just like to conclude by saying that this case involves, in our view, very serious interests that are interests that the nations of the world have recognized are interests of foreign nationals. The foreign nationals have no remedy. The Seventh Circuit indicated that there is a sound basis in international comedy for recognizing a need for foreign nationals to have their own independent remedy, to recognize the injury to them and not a derivative injury, and that that is another sound basis for this Court to hold the Seventh Circuit's reasoning is, in fact, rational and, in fact, makes sense in the context of the unitary method of taxation. There is, in our view, really no doubt that there is a substantial and overwhelming burden on foreign companies imposing this tax, on which this tax is imposed. The problem is not...
Why is it that a foreign corporation has standing to object to a violation of the United States Constitution if it's not doing business here? Is it only because you're doing business here that you get that standing?
No, I think it's recognized that we have a right to object to a constitutional violation.
Why? Because you're
doing
business?
Because I think this Court has recognized that the constitutional rights that are available under the Constitution are available to anyone in the position to argue them. We've come here to argue those rights.
You mean someone in India can argue that there's a violation of the Constitution of the United States that affects them?
If there's some injury to someone in India for which there is a remedy in this Court and for which there is a constitutional violation that is cognizable under constitutional law, it could come here and argue that.
Thank you, Mr. Salibra. Mr. Laddish, do you have rebuttal? You have
just a couple of points, Your Honor. The argument for the other side basically is arguing the merits as to the validity of California's method of taxation. These are not properly before the Court today, and I will not counter with our own counter-arguments. I would point out a few things that this Court has held in the past, and that is in Amarada Hess just last term, this Court held that the taxpayer cannot meet the burden of demonstrating no rational relationship between the income attributed to California and the intrastate values of the enterprise in California. If the unitary nature of the activities are established, which they are stipulated in this case, and if the benchmark three-factor apportionment formula is used, which the stipulation showed it was used in this case.
Mr. Laddish, I guess I don't agree with you that it's not fair game to argue the merits along with the standing issue. It's not at all unusual that the merits issue and the standing issue boil down to one and the same thing. It happens all the time.
I think
chilling effect, whether someone who's chilled by First Amendment or something else, the question whether the person has standing to sue and the question whether he wins by reason of a chill, whether a chill would be enough to give him victory, or one and the same question. So,
there are certainly times, Your Honor, when that's true. But I think in that when you're dealing with the Foreign Commerce Clause and the situation we are here, for the reasons that I stated before, they are not one and the same. Certainly, there are statutes that create injuries, and if you violate that statute, you are injured, and it'd be very hard to separate out the standing injury from the decision on the merits. But that is not the case today. If it's determined that they do not have standing here, that does not mean that does away with all the arguments that they are making as far as it being invalid under the Foreign Commerce Clause. The taxpayers can make that argument, and as pointed out by one of the amici supporting the respondents today, there is litigation in the California courts that are raising these issues now, and one of the litigants is a subsidiary. And the other one is an intervening parent, but the ultimate parent is not a part of the
Well, I understand litigation from your adversary to say the Ninth Circuit has decided that these issues can't be raised.
Ninth Circuit has only decided that as to the Ninth Circuit first decided that there was no standing, mm-hmm. But as to the Tax Injunction Act, the Ninth Circuit decided in a rather mechanical version that the control that the sole stockholder would have over its taxpayer should not be considered by the court as giving it an effective remedy in the California courts. It just said since they cannot proceed.
Well, you're arguing that it is an effective remedy.
Yes, I certainly am.
And so you're arguing the Ninth Circuit is wrong as well as the Seventh.
On that, yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Laddish. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.